Right, good evening everyone, thank you all for coming. Welcome to this penultimate meeting at Civil Society event of this term. We're very pleased this evening to have Professor Stuart Eldon, who's come over from the University of Durham. He's a professor of geography. He's the editor of Environment and Planning, the Society in Space. He's also very well known for a very popular blog and internet website called Progressive Geographies. He has won the RGS Murchison Award in 2011 for work contributing to publications in political geography. And his book that was published last year, called Terror and Territory, The Global Extent of Sovereignty, won the Association of American Geographers Blue Book Award for Public Understanding of Geography, and also the Political Geography Speciality Group Julian Mingy Outstanding Research Award. This evening he's going to be talking to us about his project called Shakespearean Characters. So with that, please welcome Professor Stuart Eldon.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Chris, for organising this lecture. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for coming to listen to me this evening. I've been working on territory for a number of years, and I've been working on territory in a number of different registers. Some of it has been very political work, thinking about territory in relation to ideas around globalisation, the European Union, the international legal notion of territorial integrity, and in the book that was just mentioned in terms of the war on terror. But I've also been trying to think about territory in a way that's perhaps a little bit different from many political geographers, in trying to think about territory as a concept, and trying to think territory as a concept in relation to some other geographical concepts that people think about. So thinking about territory in relation to space and to place, in relation to land and terrain, thinking about debates about deterritorialization, and something I'll say a little bit more about in a moment, about whether we could think territory as a political technology, similar to the way that Foucault thinks about population. And over the past several years, I've been working on a very long book, which is now finally finished, which is a history of the concept of territory, to try to trace the emergence of this concept within Western political thought, to suggest that there are a number of ways in which the relation between place and power has been understood at different times and in different places, out of which our modern concept of territory emerges at a particular historical time. And part of the reason I've been doing this is because I was unhappy with the two standard ways that I think the notion of territory was understood. One of those ways was, I think, the way that you could understand territory through the notion of territoriality. And because there was an extensive literature on territoriality, that was sufficient to understand the complexities of the idea of territory. So the most famous book of that probably is Robert Sack's book called Human Territoriality, Its Theory and Its History, where he thinks about the way that territories operate at a number of different spatial scales, from when the door to this room was closed to say to people that the session was now in progress, that we were in this. This was an act of bordering, of controlling, of policing, of regulating. This room, through that act, becomes a territory. And Sack's argument is that you can extend that up to look at areas such as this college, this town, or an area of the town, up to the region, up to the scale of the state. And that argument is an argument that has found quite a lot of adherence within geography and have used this notion of territoriality through the active shaping and making of spatial relations and creating territories through that idea. The second way that territory tends to be understood, and this is quite often the initial definition in, for example, a political geography textbook or an international relations text, is that a territory is a bounded space and that the state, in Anthony Giddens' phrase, is a bordered power container. Now, that idea isn't something that contradicts the first idea. It can be through the act of bordering, it can be through the power relations that you create a territory. But this argument that basically territory is a relatively straightforward concept, it's simply a bounded, controlled space, has also found a number of people who've used that as the basis for their determination and then have gone on and examined the complexities of particular territories, particular territorial disputes, particular territorial arrangements. But I wanted to say, well, what if it was more complicated than that? What if there was a history to these ideas, and what if this was a particular way of ordering things that emerged at a particular time that has become now so commonplace that we find it difficult to imagine how things might have been in any other way? And so I was very influenced by this book by the French writer Paul Allier's, a book called The Invention of Territory, where he suggests that territory always seems to be linked to possible definitions of the state, giving that a physical basis which seems to render it inevitable and eternal. And it was partly to try and open that up as a problem, to say that actually that might actually be something that's worth interrogating. To open up this question of territory in relation to the history of the state might make us understand that all of these as concepts have histories, that they have been organised in different ways and at different times. So I wanted to do a project which was a conceptual history of territory, taking territory not just as a practice, but as a concept that has a history, that people have organised the relation between place and power in different ways, in different times and places. And two kind of key questions shaped the work that I wanted to do on that question. One was influenced by the philosopher Edward Casey in a book that he wrote on the concept of place. And Casey suggests that that book is to try to think about the relation of the idea of place to the idea of space. So this was one of my questions. What has the history of the concept of space got to do with the history of territory? What understanding of space was necessary for a notion of territory to become possible? And the second one was to think about it in relation to the state. What if we can think about the history of the state in relation to the space over which it controls, the space that it lays claim to, the space that it polices, regulates, and organises? So thinking about the relation of the state to the emergence of the category of space within Western philosophical thought, to think of that politically as a way that might help us to make sense of the question of territory. And I tried to work this through in a range of ways, to try to suggest that things like the political economic way of thinking about these ideas was necessary to an understanding, but it wasn't in itself sufficient. So it seems to me that thinking about territory effectively as if it's land is useful, but it isn't in on itself sufficient to understand the complexities of territory. Land is a relation of property, of thinking about buying and selling, exchanging, distribution, and so on. Key elements to understanding territory, absolutely, but not sufficient to answer all of the complexities of it. Nor did it seem to me that the political strategic was sufficient to understand the complexities of territory. You can't simply think this through in terms of power relations, in terms of the power of the military, for example. The notion of terrain seems to me to be useful in thinking about this, and I think it's something particularly that human geographers haven't interrogated as an idea as much as they might have done. But to think about the conflict, the strategic relations, the military, and so on, important, but again, not sufficient to getting this question in the way that I thought was necessary to thinking about it. So I suggested that we needed to think about territory going beyond either simply the political economic or the political strategic. And the first way that I did this was to think about a whole set of questions in the political legal register. So to think about ideas of power and authority, jurisdiction, sovereignty, supremacy, superiority, political legal kinds of concepts, and to think about them in terms of their relation to geography. What does this power or this law apply to? Where does that law actually apply, and where does that law stop applying? So when you cross maybe a boundary line, the law of one country ceases to apply and the law of another country begins to apply. Thinking about that question of the law, but thinking it geographically, seemed to me to add a key element into thinking about the idea of territory. And one of the particular historical questions I became interested in is when the notion of territorium, which used to mean the property of people, the property of a city, the property of a king, his property in lands, when did that become the object of political rule, the thing over which political rule was actually exercised? The extent of that political rule. It applies in these places, it doesn't apply once you leave that particular place. The second element I tried to introduce into this was to think about what I'm calling the political technical. To think about how a whole range of techniques, particularly as they emerge in the 16th and 17th century, help to shape the way that political actors, notably states, control and command large extents of land. So how does the advances in geometry, particularly the development of coordinate or analytic geometry, how does that impact cartography, practices in land surveying? How does this relate to the sorts of things that are done to populations at the same time through political arithmetic, through statistics, through accurate census data? All of these as mechanisms or techniques that states and other political actors use to control the resources that they have. How does that element figure in this question of territory? What this then led me to was this idea that you could take Foucault's idea of population and the way that he sees population emerge as the object of government at a particular time, and that the governance of that, the kind of arts or techniques directed towards the population, were dependent on these calculative ways of thinking, these calculative modes of command. How does this relate to the question of territory? How might we think territory as a political technology, or perhaps better, a bundle of political technologies, the particular kinds of techniques that are used to measure the land, to control the terrain, and to think those elements alongside the economic and the strategic, in thinking territory politically, certainly, but thinking it in a more expanded sense of the political than simply thinking it in an economic or a strategic kind of register. And what I'm trying to suggest in this work is not that through doing this I come up with a better definition of territory, in the sense that you could kind of copy this down, put it into a political geography textbook, and that it will be better than the definitions of territory I said were problematic a few moments ago. Rather, the thing I'm trying to do here is to say territory is so complicated, what we actually need to do is have a set of questions that we can ask in order to understand how it's been understood and practiced in different times and in different places. And what I'm suggesting is that if you ask economic questions and strategic questions and legal questions and technical questions, you'll begin to grasp the complexity of this relation between political rule and the spaces, the geographies over which that political rule is exercised. And that's really what I'm trying to do here, is not to come up with a better definition, but to raise the kinds of questions that we need to ask. So I've worked this through in two books. One of them is the very political book, the Terror and Territory book that was mentioned in the introduction, which thinks through some of these ideas, particularly in relation to the last 20 years or so, particularly since the end of the Cold War and especially since September 11th, 2001. How do the relations of territory and the exercise of sovereignty by states, how have these been changed, challenged, transformed by what's been happening in the War on Terror? And then the second book is a historical book that looks at the emergence of the concept of territory along the kind of lines that I've been suggesting. It's a book that will be out sometime next year. Now, this is the slide that you're not going to be able to see because of the size of the font, but it's just to give you a sense of what that book actually contains. It starts with ancient Greek myth and Greek tragedy. It works all the way up to the beginning of the 18th century, rereading a very expanded canon of Western political thought and Western philosophy to try to look at this relation between place and power in a number of these texts, to try to think about how a whole range of thinkers tried to organise this relation. So how did the Greek polis, the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire and other medieval practices, the emergence of the modern state, how can we think these kinds of questions in relation to the idea of territory? And it's an extremely big book. When I sent off the final manuscript, it was 850 pages. It's going to be about a 500-page book when it's finished. It's 200,000 words, and it's done. I've just finished the copy editing, so there really is nothing more I can do. I just have to check the proofs to make sure they've done what I asked them to do. So the book is done, and I really thought I was done with the question of territory. I had other things I wanted to work on. I had a book project on Foucault that I wanted to work on. I had an idea of working on philosophies of the world and globalisation. And then I realised I still had something I wanted to say about territory. Because right at the end of chapter 8, there's a short section on Shakespeare's play King Lear. And in King Lear, it's one of the two places in Shakespeare's work where he uses the word territory. It's a very rare word in Shakespeare. And I wrote this piece on King Lear, and it became far too big to fit into the book in the place that I had set out for it. So it developed into a single article, and I thought, well, maybe I'm done with that as a single article. Unfortunately, that wasn't the end of it. I realised that there was something I wanted to say about Coriolanus. That led me to Richard II, and I kept expanding this as these different papers and so on. Eventually, I thought, what if I'm actually writing a book on Shakespeare and territory? And that's what I want to talk to you about in the remainder of the time today. So as I said, Shakespeare doesn't use the word territory very often. It's only in the folio edition of King Lear, it's not in the quarto text, and it's in As You Like It. He uses the plural territories, often largely as a synonym for lands, so simply meaning the lands that might be controlled by a landowner, by a feudal baron or a prince or somebody. He uses that in a few more plays, and even one of those plays is probably not a scene that was actually written by Shakespeare, although most people seem to accept at least parts of Edward III were written by Shakespeare. So if you simply count up the number of instances that Shakespeare uses the word, you don't get very far, and it might appear that territory is not particularly important to Shakespeare. But actually, if you look at a number of Shakespeare's plays, you can see that all sorts of questions that we would associate with territory are talked about in his plays. So exile or banishment, succession, conquest, contestation, a whole range of questions about spatial division around the politics of land and the economics of land. And so it seemed to me that there was a potential for doing something with Shakespeare's plays to open up some of these complexities that I was trying to suggest there were in the notion of territory. And Shakespeare, it seemed to me, was writing at a particularly interesting time. He's writing in the late 16th and early 17th century, which is the period that in that book I make the argument this is the time the modern notion of territory is really coalescing, that all of the different elements that come into the notion come together around that time in a range of political writings by philosophers and theorists, by people working on behalf of kings and emperors, by people that are trying to work out what the legacy of peace treaties is in terms of political practice. And Shakespeare's writing at this time. So it seemed to me that potentially Shakespeare, with one eye forward and one eye backward, could open up some of the limits and ambiguities and tensions and problems around the idea of territory. Shakespeare's writing in late Elizabethan and early Jacobean England. It's a space that by his time is relatively, and I want to stress relatively, bordered and ordered. It's organised, the political control is relatively consolidated. But the plays show a very different historical past, and sometimes the historical past is used to invoke elements in what's actually happening at the time he's writing. But if you look at Shakespeare's history plays, if you look at King Lear with the contest between the daughters of Lear over the division of the kingdom, if you look at Coriolanus with the idea of the victorious general Coriolanus being banished from Rome and then leading an assault against Rome, you see in Hamlet, I think, a very important geopolitical kind of framing to the story where all of the action that's going on within the court is enclosed within the wider geopolitical struggles between Norway, Poland and Denmark. You can see something similar, I think, in Macbeth. In The Tempest, Shakespeare's thinking about how Europe comes into contact with its outside, his most obviously colonial play. So in a whole range of these plays, Shakespeare seems to me to open up conceptually, historically, politically, questions around territory that could be worth exploring. So I've come to this as the kind of draft plan for the book that I think I'm writing around these ideas. And it's to use readings of single plays and some paired plays to open up different elements of the question of territory. So this is this argument I'm making. Territory, yes, of course, is a geographical concept. Yes, of course, it's a political concept. But it's also within those and beyond those got elements of the economic, the legal, the technical, various different ways that we can think about territory that maybe these plays open up and give different perspectives on. I obviously don't have time to talk about all of those aspects tonight. So what I'm going to do is just provide a reading of Henry V, and particularly the first two scenes of Henry V, to try to talk about some of those ideas. Now, Henry V is one of Shakespeare's most famous histories. It's one that often stands alone as something that's performed. It's often filmed, so there's the famous filming of Henry V in 1944 by Laurence Olivier, when Britain is just about to invade France again to get rid of the Nazis. It's a filming of a much earlier invasion of France, but for a particular patriotic purpose. There was another famous version by Kenneth Branagh in the late 1980s. There was a version much more recently that was part of the BBC's Hollow Crown, showing this play in a more modernised reading of the text in that play. And it's a play, I think, that's got some very interesting geographies. There's the interesting bit right at the beginning, when the character called the Chorus, who's sort of introducing the action and sort of standing outside of the dramatic action of the play, but offering a kind of commentary on the play. The Chorus is talking about the cockpit, this place, this stage, which is like this kind of enclosed place where cocks might fight, as they did in Shakespearean England, or the wooden O, the framing of the theatre. And he asks, can this hold what he calls the vasty fields of France, the territories and the battlefields which the action of the play is going to be concerned with? And fields runs as a key theme through this play, both the agricultural sense of fields, but also the battlefields over which the future of the kingdoms of England and France will be decided. The chorus continues to say that suppose within the girdle on these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. This is meant to signify the division of England and France, with the English Channel running between them, the fronts meeting not simply as the fronts of an army, but the cliffs of Dover particularly. Doesn't quite work quite so well with the geography of northern France, but it's this idea that you're going to try within this very small enclosed room to show the magnificence of this battle that's been between these two conflicting powers. Now, what I'm interested in particularly in this is in the opening scene of the play. There's this discussion between two bishops, the Bishop of Ely and the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they discuss the threats to what they call their temporal lands. Now, temporal lands are lands that the church owns directly. It doesn't own them because it's the church, but it owns them because it is wealthy. It owns these as its own property. These are lands that the church might control and command, that it might have agricultural wealth coming from these. They're not controlled by the church as the church, but because the church happens to be wealthy. Now, what they're worried about is that the king is going to take them away from them. And the king is going to take them away because then the king can raise his own revenue from these lands, and he can use this to keep his court in a magnificent way, that he can use this to get up an army so that he can put down perhaps a rebellion in Ireland or so on. The king wants to take the wealth from the church, the lands from the church, as the source of wealth from them. And there's a discussion of a bill, a political act going through Parliament that will disinherit the church of such lands. And it's a bill that we hear that Henry's father, Henry IV, had tried to pass, but it hadn't been able to be passed in his time because of the turbulence of that reign, the inability of that king to secure things politically. But the key legal struggle in the play is not between the church and the state, because the bishops are able quite effectively to get Henry to think about something else. What they want him to do is to launch an invasion of France instead and take France and the wealth from France for the purposes he wishes to take the lands from the church. So the bishops are trying to steer him down another course politically. And they make the claim that the king is legitimate in owning France. So the Archbishop of Canterbury says, "For I have made an offer to his majesty upon our spiritual convocation, and in regard of causes now in hand, which I have opened to his grace at large, as touching France, to give a greater sum than ever at one time the clergy yet did to his predecessors part withal." France is going to give much more than simply the lands of the church within England. So they're trying to push Henry down this route in terms of the political. And there's a whole range of legal questions that they use to try to justify why this might legitimately be the case. The key question is something called the Salic Law. Now, the Salic Law says that in Salic land, no woman shall succeed. No woman is able to inherit lands in that particular geographical location. Now, Henry has a complicated lineage to the French crown, but through a female link in the family chain. And the claim that the archbishops make is not about whether the law applies, but where the law applies. They say it's clear that if you cannot inherit down the woman's line, down the female lineage, in Salic lands, the question is, what do the Salic lands apply to? Now, France claims the Salic lands are France. The English archbishops are making the claim they actually lie to the east in modern-day Germany, between the Elbe River and modern-day France. So the argument that they're trying to make is, yes, this law, the Salic law, is important and it's legitimate, but it just simply doesn't apply to France. The law doesn't apply to this area. Therefore, Henry V, through the route through Edward III, up to Charles V, can make the claim to the laws of France. Now, the king knows the potential of this, but he's worried about what's actually going to happen if he actually does launch an invasion of France. He's worried about the amount of blood that will be spilt about this. So he asks the archbishop to explain the situation very carefully to make sure that there is a truly legitimate claim to this. "For God doth know how many now in health shall drop their blood in approbation of what your reverence shall incite us to. Therefore take heed how you impawn our person, how you awake our sleeping sword of war. We charge you in the name of God, take heed." And Canterbury replies, "It's only if the Salic law applies to France that Henry's claim to France would be illegitimate. Now, this play scene, the scene in this play, is often played for humour. They kind of think that this is so, kind of, the legal complexities are so tangled up and intertwined and so on, that you have these kind of clown-like figures of the archbishops trying to read from a whole number of pages of script in order to try to make this claim. My sense is this is deadly serious, and this is extremely important in terms of these legal complexities and the lands, the political geographical question, to which they apply. Henry V, being the kind of person that he is, wants to cut straight to the end of this. He says, forget all of those legal complexities. May I, with right and conscience, make this claim? I want a yes or no answer to this. I don't want all of the family history traced. I don't want all of the legal complexities worked through. I want to know if I can make this claim. And the Archbishop does give him exactly that encouragement. He quotes scripture to say about this succession and the rights of it. And he says, gracious Lord, stand back for your own, unwind your bloody flag, look back into your mighty ancestors. Go, my dread Lord, to your great-grandsire's tomb, from whom you claim, that's Edward III, invoke his warlike spirit and your great-uncle, Edward the Black Prince, who on the French ground played a tragedy, making defeat on the full power of France. Now, that's a fairly effective piece of rhetoric because it links the legal and the patriotic claims to the throne, both of birthright and of martial courage. But there are a whole set of complexities that are glossed over here. Henry V, this is the current king, only holds the crown because his father, Henry IV, took it from Richard II. Richard II was deposed as king by Henry IV. This is the only reason that Henry is king, is because his father basically stole the crown. Who was Richard II? Well, he was the son of Edward the Black Prince, the one who is now being held up as the martial exemplar for Henry to follow in terms of his invasion of France. Now, various other bishops and noblemen support this cause. Bishop of Ely, the Dukes of Exeter and Westmorland, and they keep talking about this idea of blood. Blood both as the ties of inheritance, the link in the family relations, the blood coursing through veins as the martial spirit that's being called upon to act and to claim France, but also in terms of the blood that will be spilt as the consequences of war. The Duke of Exeter says, your brother kings and monarchs of the earth do all expect that you shall rouse yourself as did the former lions of your blood. And there's all sorts of language of blood soaking into the earth and the links this has of the bodies and the lands or the geographies over which they may be fighting. And we hear this in terms of a whole range of people coming behind Henry to try to push them forward into the war. Now, what's interesting about this is Henry is warned not to neglect questions closer to home in terms of control of political geographies, in terms of territory, you might say. He says, we must not arm only to invade the French, but lay down our proportions to defend against the Scot, who will make road upon us with all advantages. Part of his army should be kept at home, because the Scots are likely to use the opportunity given by the armies going over to France to launch an invasion from the north into England. This is exactly the same thing that had happened to Edward III a couple of generations before. So the king asks for an estimate of what is needed. There's all this talk about the kinds of parts of his army he should leave behind to leave troops garrisoned in the north to protect against the Scots, and that these should be under the command of the Duke of Westmorland. They of those marches, gracious sovereign, shall be a wall sufficient to defend our inland from the pilfering borderers. So there's a whole range of geographical questions here. The marches being the borderlands, the frontier zone between England and Scotland. The wall obviously invokes Hadrian's Wall, but there's also this protection that a well-armed force would give as a wall, as a fortification against an invasion from Scotland. The inland, i.e. the internal parts rather than the coastlands, need the protection from the marauding Scots. And the king replies, I won't read the whole quote here, but it's about this idea of not simply the coursing snatchers, so sort of smash and grab raids that might come over the border to take property or to do other things and then return back to Scotland, but the main intendment of the Scot, the main intention that the Scottish forces might be used to actually launch a more wholesale invasion of northern Britain. He's thinking about the way in the time of Edward III, that the Scot had exploited an undefended kingdom and had made use of this in order to gain things for themselves. And the Archbishop of Canterbury fills in some of the detail, talking about the capture of the Scottish king at the Battle of Neville's Cross in Durham. So that the advice being given to the king, there's a saying very old and true, that if you will France win, then will Scotland first begin. And this story about this idea that Scotland is this marauder that might come over the border, that it might, the weasel Scot, as it says, come sneaking up, what the mouse will do in the absence of the cat, and so on. All of these things that if you take all of your army and you move south to invade France, you mustn't leave the north of the country undefended. And the king, this is a famous part of one of these opening scenes, the king then gets the ambassadors from the French king's son, the Dauphin, to come to his court because he wants to present them with this legal claim that he has, he says, to the lands of France. And famously, the Dauphin gives him an answer by saying, instead of laying claim to these lands, I'm going to give you treasure. And there's a box of treasure, and when they open the box of treasure, it's tennis balls. Tennis balls fall out of this box. This is the treasure that has been given by France to England in place of these claims. So it's clearly an insult. Why tennis balls? We discover later they're called Paris balls, the idea that the game of tennis had come from France to England, and that this is in a sense kind of showing that we've given some kind of cultural things to England, but we're not going to give them the lands of France. Henry responds very forcefully, and this is where the time Henry has clearly decided upon war. We are glad the Dauphin is so pleasant with us. His present and your pains we thank you for. When we have matched our rackets to these balls, we will in France, by God's grace, play a set shall strike his father's crown into the hazard. So the stage then is set for the famous parts of the play, the Battle of Agincourt, the Siege of Harfleur, the various speeches that Henry gives to try to get his troops motivated in order to attack France, the Once More Into a Breach, Dear Friends, the St. Crispin's Day speech where he's motivating the forces, all of the patriotic parts of the play, and then followed at the end of the play with the wooing of the French Princess Catherine, the attempt to unify the families of France and England through the marriage of the daughter of the French king to the present King of England. Catherine says to him, how could I love the enemy of France? And Henry replies, well, in loving me, you shall love the friend of France, for I love France so well that I will not part with a village of it. So it's this laying claim to the possession of France, and that you can bring these two parts, these two kingdoms together through this marriage. And that's the scene, some of you may know this, where the king then tries to speak to Catherine in truly execrable French because she doesn't understand English, or at least she pretends she doesn't really understand English. And it's again played for kind of humour in the play. But it seems important in terms of working out again a lineage together of bringing these two crowns together. And late in the play, Henry is proclaimed to be the King of England and the heir to France. Not yet the King of France, but the heir to France. When the present King of France dies, Henry will also become the King of France, rather than the French King's son, the Dauphin. And the French King wishes that this will bring the two countries together, that Henry should take Catherine as his wife, take her fair son, and from her blood raise up issue to me that the contending kingdoms of France and England, whose very shores look pale with envy of each other's happiness, may cease their hatred, and this dear conjunction plant neighbourhood and Christian-like accord in their sweet bosoms, that never war advanced his bleeding sword twixt England and fair France. But we know, historically, that this won't actually last. The final lines of the play start to hint at what's actually to come outside of the dramatic action of this play. Henry V dies at the age of only 35. He leaves behind an infant son, Henry VI. But there's so much contestation between different power forces within England through Henry VI's reign that France ends up getting lost and England gets torn apart through the Wars of the Roses and so on. So the whole contest that happens from this. And you might note that Catherine, after Henry dies, Catherine marries again. She marries Henry Tudor, who's the grandfather of Henry VII, who gains out of the Battle of the Wars of the Roses, who gains the English crown. But what's interesting there is that that's through the female line of descent. It's through Catherine being the queen and remarrying that this creates the lineage to Henry VII and the beginning of the Tudor dynasty of English kings. And what Shakespeare also does at the end of Henry V is he hints towards the story of Henry VI, and Shakespeare, of course, had written three plays about the reign of Henry VI, and the one following it, Richard III. Now, Shakespeare writes his two great historical tetralogies, the works of four plays together, in reverse order to how they are historically, so that Richard II, the two parts of Henry IV and Henry V, are written after the three parts of Henry VI and Richard III. But what Shakespeare does at the end of Henry V, the last of these historical plays to be written, is he links the dramatic story into the beginning of the Henry plays. So you could run them chronologically and they would be consistent through that. It's the kind of prequel kind of idea that we now get in Hollywood movies. What I've tried to do then in talking about these scenes in Henry V is to open up some of these legal, strategic, contestation, succession, these kinds of arguments about how we might think about the idea of territory, of family relations, of inheritance, of dowries that might be given through marriage and so on. And other parts of the project try to open up different aspects, the question of territory. So about division and the politics of land through King Lear, the corporeal nature of the body of the state in Coriolanus, the colonial, the technical, the economic, what might lie outside of territory. And it's these kinds of broad-ranging issues that I think Shakespeare allows us to address, that I hope allows me to present the way I'm trying to think about the question of territory in a rather different way than I did in the very historical work, The Birth of Territory. Shakespeare, it seems to me, opens up these complexities around territory conceptually, historically, politically, and that the way that I want to try and suggest we should think about territory is not simply as a political and a geographical concept, or that political and geographical are not simple concepts to approach the question of territory, but need to take into account the economic, the legal, the technical, the political, the strategic, and so on. And that Shakespeare, with the breadth and the richness of his plays, allows us to answer some of those questions. Thank you.